Welcome to this episode of Living Legends, Where Are They Now? Sponsored by the New Farm Insider. I'm your host today, John Reitman, and our guest is Joe Alonzi. Joe's a retired superintendent who's worked at several golf courses in the metropolitan New York area. And Joe, it's good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us today. I was hoping we could start with you giving us a brief snapshot of your career. Tell us some of the places you've been and how you got started in the golf business.
Sure. Well, actually, I got started in the golf business when I was about 16 years old and in high school. And I was looking for a summer job. And my brother, who was also in the golf business, was working at Tamarack Country Club in Greenwich, Connecticut. And I asked him if he could speak to the superintendent and see if they had any openings for the summer, which they did. And that was the beginning of what would turn out to be about 50 years of work on golf courses. At that time, a couple of years later, I graduated high school. And I went to RCA Institutes of Technology in New York City, where I studied electrical engineering. I graduated from there, and that had to be around 1970-ish. When you get to my age, you don't remember all the dates.
Yeah, sure. No, no.
Anyway,
what was your goal coming out of RCA? What did you want to do with your life at that point?
I actually got a job with United Aircraft, and that was the Vietnam era, and I was working on the F-111 fighter jet. I was actually working on the radar system for that, and Vietnam came to a screeching end at that point, and I was laid off. So I went back to work at that point. My brother had become a superintendent, and I went to work for him at Burning Tree Country Club. Then I got married shortly thereafter, and I got called back to United Aircraft, and I said, you know, I really don't want to go back to an office, to that type of an environment. So I said to my brother, what would be the chances of me sticking around all year? And he had an opening, so as luck would have it, I stayed with him. After that first year, I enrolled at Rutgers University for their turf school, and I did that for 2 years. I graduated from there. And the very next year, I got my first superintendent's job at Huntington Crescent Club in Huntington, Long Island. I was there for 10 years, at which point I moved to Fenway Golf Club in Scarsdale, New York. And I worked at Fenway for 8 years. And Fenway has a pretty good family history for us because after I left, my brother went there, and after my brother left, my nephew went there, and he's still there. So since 1984, when I went to Fenway, there's been an Alonzi at the helm just about the whole time. So from Fenway in 1992, I was offered the job at Westchester Country Club, where I spent the next 23 years. Westchester was kind of the one of the largest jobs in the Northeast, I would say, if not the largest. And I say that only because of the size of Westchester Country Club. It's some 400 acres and 45 holes and a beach club and a hotel. It's a little city within itself. I spent the last 23 years there.
A lot of road maintenance there with the job as well, right?
It's like 7 miles of roads. We've got three entrances from three different sides of the property, and all the roads within that system is it's all part of the Realty of Westchester Country Club. So within that 23 years, we've had 17 PGA events, which I thoroughly enjoyed each one of them. Until I didn't have them anymore, and then I said, "Wow, this is like I died and went to heaven. There's not much to do anymore." So there I was. I retired at the end of 2014, and soon after I retired, I was having breakfast with my wife, and I said to her, "What's going on? You seem down in the dumps ever since I retired." And she looked at me and said, "You know, you were a superintendent for 40 years. You worked 7 days a week, almost all year long, except for a couple of months in the wintertime, at which point you went to conventions and other events. And I pretty much have my own life." So I said, "Okay." I thought about what she said, and I said, "You know, it's not fair to her. You know, she's had girlfriends, she's had the children. We had four kids, and she pretty much raised them herself during, especially in the summertime. We never had anything that was called a summer vacation in those years." So then she said to me, "And now you're looking for lunch, breakfast, lunch, and dinner." You're cramping my style. So I decided that I was going to open a little business.
Oh, wow.
And to keep myself busy and to really stay out of her hair. And a friend of mine had recently retired, and he owned a business that he catered to golf courses. He catered to their needs, such as tires and batteries and uniforms and kind of hardware stuff that, you know, if you need something, you have to take your assistant or one of your high paid guys, knowledgeable and speaks English, to go and purchase the stuff. And I decided to go after that. And I'm in my second year of it, and it's working out pretty well so far.
And what's the name of that venture?
Biltmore Turf Specialties. And there's a story behind the Biltmore. Biltmore, Westchester Country Club, when it was first originated, was the Biltmore Country Club, the part of the Biltmore Hotel chains and that. And I was putting together my LLC, and I was on the phone with my lawyer, and I happened to have been at Westchester, and I was driving out, and he said, "Joe, I need a name for this business that you want to start." And I looked up at the street sign, and it said Biltmore Avenue. So I said, "How about Biltmore Turf Specialties?" And there's the name of my new company.
But the Vanderbilts aren't associated with your business or anything?
No. Just I wish it was just the street sign. So that's my short version of the last 40 plus years.
Now you actually were born in Italy, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Tell, when did you come to the United States, and why did your parents come here?
Well, my grandfather, both of my grandfathers, my mother's and my father's fathers, were living here. And it was part of a migration. You know, there was nothing, there wasn't a lot in Italy, and they decided to migrate to the United States. My parents did. And since both of my grandfathers were here, they were able to sponsor us. And we came, I was barely 5 years old. So I really, it's not that I, you know, I can understand the language a little bit, but I never really followed it to the point or you know, learned the language, the Italian language that well. So I've had 5 years of Italian, I guess. that's it. Well, yes, I was born in Italy, and I've been back. It's a beautiful, beautiful country. Here I am, you know, and my brother as well. My brother, I believe, was about 12 years old.
So your grandparents were here, but your parents at the time were still in Italy.
Well, not my grandparents. My grandfathers, the grandmothers were still back in Italy. There was no work back in the early 50s in Italy. So they came to America to look for work and to send money home. And they must have said, you know, this isn't a bad place to be. And they slowly, you know, they sponsored my mother's father sponsored us to come. And then my uncles came, you know, one at a time, but eventually the whole family made it here.
Yeah, I guess post World War II, that had to be a pretty tough place to be.
Yeah, it was, and that was it. That was really, it was just nothing there. So here we are.
So, all right, then we'll fast forward. You went to Rutgers and worked for your brother. You know, from that point, from the early 70s there, and right after that Vietnam era, to the time up until you retired and Dave took over for you, how had the turf management business changed in that time?
Oh, gosh. Well, when I first went to Huntington Crescent, my first job, I got there in the wintertime. When spring came along, we started mowing greens. I started mowing the greens back then about 3/16 of an inch, which would be 0.160 or something like that. The members in the spring started playing, and I was like the biggest hero in town because the greens were pretty fast. I would say they were rolling maybe at a 6.5, 7, you know, looking back. But in prior years, they were cutting them at 1/4 inch. So it was kind of instant success just by lowering the mower a little bit. And probably that was the beginning of what has become one of the biggest problems for superintendents over the years, is the speed of greens, with the demands of 13, 14, 15 not being fast enough on a snip meter. So, I'm not taking the blame for that. I'm just saying that's when everybody started to lower their mowers at that point.
You might not be taking it, but some people might be placing it on you.
Maybe. But that's really what had happened. When we went from 1/4 inch down to 3/16, and before you know it, 3/16 wasn't low enough, and we kept going further, getting it tighter and tighter, making the equipment so that it could mow that low. And we would literally grind the bottom of the bed knives to make them thinner so that they wouldn't drag on the grass and cut that much lower to get them below 3/16, because that's, you know, back then 1/4 inch was pretty much a standard. So and then the TV and the tournaments and members watching watching TV and wanting the same conditions as they saw on TV, it's probably been the biggest problem for superintendents even now, is definitely the speed of the greens and the pressure to keep them at that point or at that speed for an extended period of time.
You know, and the thing then was analog TV showed everything nice and green. Now you have high def,
yeah,
where it shows
yeah,
any imperfections,
right,
now or that you wouldn't have noticed,
yeah,
before are there for the whole world to,
right,
see now.
Yeah. Yeah. Now it's totally changed. So you've got all that to deal with too.
Yeah.
And, now you've got the regulations and the chemicals and, the climate change and all of this going on in the world that who knows where it's going to go.
As you now get on this treadmill of lowering your mowing heights to increase speed, and then that opens up all this other can of worms with diseases that you'd never heard of before and all sorts of problems that,
right,
were new to you. Can you sort of walk us through maybe a little bit when, you know, as the mowing height started to go down, maybe how that correlated to some things that you started to notice that were unfamiliar to you up to that point?
Well, first off, my first year, we ran into some insect problems. And they were relatively new, in the early 70s. And the biggest problem was the Hyperoides weevil,
mm-hmm,
which was pretty much discovered on Long Island for the first time. And I think it came about because of all the PLOA that kind of infested all the golf courses. And it just devours the POA, or they devour the POA, I should say. And we got those under control somewhat to the point where it was acceptable for the golfer. But over a period of years with the Hyperoides and very limited chemicals to wipe them out. And I'm going to backtrack just a little bit. What I think happened was prior to the Hyperoides becoming a problem, I think we had some chemicals. Mercury was one of them. I don't remember all the names of all the chemicals that go back that far, but the EPA eliminated them from our use. So all of a sudden, all these insects are starting to appear that we didn't have before. I'm sure they were there at a limited time, but not in the playing areas that we would spray. So that was one of the problems. A lot of the chemicals that we were using were eliminated. Now, I'm not saying they shouldn't have been eliminated. They were eliminated for a reason. They weren't good for the environment or for the human health, I guess. But so the Hyperoides became a problem. Then the mowing heights, once we started, and not only greens, but then we started lowering the heights of fairways and tees, and we came up with some diseases that, once you cut, the more you cut off the top, the more the roots are going to diminish. So that became a problem. Anthracnose, which, was around, but nobody, it was a secondary disease. All of a sudden, anthracnose is a primary disease, and it's affecting and wiping out greens all over the place.
Yeah, when did you first notice that?
Well, I knew of anthracnose back in the 70s. It was there. But, we used to have higher heights, and it really didn't. The damage it did to the plant, there was enough plant there to sustain itself. But as we took the more of the top off and there was less plant, there would be you know, the grass plant itself weakened and the root system weakened. And before you know it, you know, the traffic and everything else on the greens, before you know it, guys were devastated. I wasn't one of them at first. So I seemed to somehow be okay with it. But, you know, we did studies at Rutgers. We did studies at Cornell. And they came up with a plan, but lo and behold, they all said, all the studies that were done for anthracnose, all the professors came back and said, raise your mowing heights and use more fertilizer. Well, that's the sure positive way to get slow greens, raise your mowing heights and use more fertilizer. So we couldn't do that. So we went back to the universities and said, we need better recommendations because more fertilizer and raising the mowing heights isn't going to work for us. And they did, and they came back with chemicals and treatments, and it seems to have controlled it to some extent, to a pretty, you know, a pretty good extent where guys' golf courses aren't being devastated by the disease anymore. But you skip a treatment or something doesn't go right, it's there, you know. It's always there, the anthracnose. Summer patch came along, same thing, raise your mowing heights. So that was another. Everything that we were having problems with since then, the first thing the professors come back from the universities, raise your mowing heights. And that's not, that can't be part of the equation. So the chemicals come in and the fertilizers and that. So, and that's, you know, that's how we've progressed over the years is that we've caused our own problems, you know, and then the rollers came up, the rollers and even faster greens. And although I don't know that the rollers really gave us a problem as much as the lower mowing heights. I think that was the cause of most of the problems that we've had.
Yeah, the rolling now seems to be the ticket to being able to raise those heights and ward off some of that disease pressure.
Yeah. And as long as you don't have too many good golfers playing 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, because you definitely got some growth and the effect of the roller is long gone by that time of the day.
Right. So. Now, tell us a little bit about what it was like to work at Westchester, you know, high profile place, real pressure cooker of a job, a lot going on there. It's a, like you said, a massive piece of property. But you know, then you have the, you know, the annual, tournament pressure and so forth, just what it was always like there, because that had to be just eat an enormous amount of your, personal time. To where your, I'm sure your family, as you'd kind of alluded to before, your family was the one that really paid the price for that.
They definitely paid the price, and I don't know that I was, I didn't pay enough attention to it at the time to realize how much they suffered from it. But to get back to Westchester, they, the membership, there's like 1,500 members. So, you know, 1,500 men with 1,500 wives with 2.3 kids. It's, that's a lot of members to deal with. But all in all, I thoroughly enjoyed the membership. You know, most of them were really, really good people. You'll get, you know, your complainers no matter what, no matter how good things are, you'll get your small percentage. But I always said that, you know, the small percentage at Westchester was like an entire membership at another club. 10% of 1,500 is 150. And some of these very private clubs only have 150, 200 members. So you don't want to have that 10% mad at you at another club. So anyway, the membership was fine. They treated me very well over the years. I have no complaints with that. The tournament took on a lot of time. We would start. We'd come out of winter, beginning of April. We start our mowing, and the day we start our first mowing, we'd be thinking tournament. Getting our walk paths straight in line with camera angles and fairway lines, and like the edges of the fairways and everything. We try to make everything match, especially to line up with where the cameras were. So it gives you a much nicer angle. And we didn't mow the fairways like they're mowing them now. We used to stripe them. So it was a really beautiful effect. But we would line up the stripes to go exactly in line with where the cameras were. So that kind of, you have to start most of those things, especially the walk paths, the dew path from tee to fairway. You got to get that right the first time, because if it's not straight, it's hard going back to realign it. So, a lot of little things that you would do just to have the whole tournament look right. That would start in April. A lot of things we would start doing right away. And we would go, 75, 80 hours a week in April and May, when most places are still, it's cool. And we weren't chasing hoses or watering or doing things like that. We were just making sure our sand depths were right, or adding sand to the bunkers. And the PGA had certain requirements not to add sand, 60 days before the tournament. So just so that it got nice and hard, and you wouldn't get lose your ball in a sand trap. It took a lot of our time, but it was something that at the end of the tournament, or from April to the end of the tournament, it was something that you could look at and say, wow, we did this, something to be proud of. We did that 17 times, 17 years.
And that sense of accomplishment you get from preparing for and hosting a successful tournament, did, over the years, did that ever get old or ever lose its shine for you?
Some of the we had some tournaments that the weather didn't cooperate, and the tournament used to be called the Westchester Classic in the earlier days. And one year, I remember the headline in the sports page, the back page, was the Wet Chester Classic, WET Chester. And we had several years where it was just that time of the year where the thunderstorms would come up in the afternoon and just wipe everything out, wash out the bunkers and slow up the greens, and kind of everything you just worked the last 8 weeks for, it would just be gone in a half hour storm. So those were the kind of things that kind of set you back and made you wonder what the hell you were doing there. But as far as the tournament itself and prepping for the tournament, the people you got to meet, the players, I've made some really good friends through the PGA, Slugger White and Mark Russell, some of the officials. that I'm still in touch with, and we get together once a year and meet up someplace and have dinner. Really, really good camaraderie with a lot of the inner workings of the tournament, the people that ran the tournament. So that was, you know, I wouldn't say, gee, I wish I hadn't done that. It was really some very positive, positive stories, and you know, looking back at all the tournaments that we had. So I'm pretty glad that I did what I did.
Now, you and your brother and your nephew and your son all working at places in the Met.
Yeah.
You know, that's an area that's, it's notorious for being a tough place. How is it that so many of you and your family have been able to climb inside that pressure cooker and survive?
Well, I think, you know, going back to being born in Italy and coming here when I was 5 years old and watching my parents, who had literally nothing, you know, other than the clothes on our back, not speaking English and looking for work, and saw how hard they worked. And my father, we were here 10 years and he bought his first house that my mother still lives in today. Just a lot of hard work and not being afraid to, you know, get your hands dirty, let's say. Anything and everything is possible. And I just, you know, I learned that from my parents, seeing how hard they worked. Both my mother and father had jobs, and you know, back then, in the mid-50s, my mother was doing piecework. She was working in a bra factory. And she would get paid by how many bras she sewed together in a day, you know, and she wound up making like $12,000 that 1 year, which was a huge amount of money. You know, she made more than my father, I think, that year. And, you know, they were able to save, but they bought that house that she still lives in for like $25,000. $25,500, I think they paid for that house. Can't buy a car for that price anymore. They were really hardworking people. They didn't waste, you know, I shouldn't say they didn't spend on things that weren't absolutely necessary. Everything, you know, whatever they spent was for the family, it was for them, for us rather. And you know, there's something to be learned from that. You know, they didn't expect anything. They didn't expect any handouts from anyone. My grandfathers, they were here, but they didn't have a lot of money because they were still sending it back to their wives in Italy. So they were supporting themselves here and sending money home for the rest of the family. So I think there's, I learned a lot from that, as did my brother. I mean, he's every bit, if not more, of a hard worker than I am. And I think if, you know, when you set your mind on something and you work hard at it, I think that's probably a recipe for something good to happen.
Now, sort of on the flip side of that, you know, I'm sure you probably up through your retirement, I'm sure you've noticed, you know, perhaps that work ethic that your generation, that became second nature to your generation and was second nature to immigrants coming over from overseas. And, you know, that if, for some of the younger generation now, that seems to, it's a common complaint I hear a lot, is that seems to be lacking.
I do see that. I do see that, you know, some of them don't pay as much attention as to certain things that, like that I would have, but they're certainly, I wouldn't say that they're really lacking. I mean, the guys that I see that are successful are putting in as many hours as I did. They're working pretty hard at it. Maybe some of the clubs that probably are not in, and I'm trying to use the right word so that I don't offend anybody. But some of the clubs that, let's say, are spending a lot of money to have a nice golf course and a nice country club for their members, those guys are working hard. They're putting in the time. Some of the other clubs that are not, they may take some things for granted, and that's probably my biggest recommendation to any superintendent is don't take your job for granted, because there's a line of people out there waiting for that one particular job that you have. And the members, as much as you may think they're on your side, let something go wrong, and they become, they're not your friend anymore. So I tried very hard not to make too many members my friends, because in the long run it does become a problem, and especially, you don't even need big problems, a stuck sprinkler head overnight and you got a flood and the guy's ball plugs. I mean, nothing you could have done for that. But, he may have been your friend the day before, and all of a sudden he's all pissed off at you because, he lost the hole. And I found that most members will blame, they won't blame a bad shot or a bad round of golf on themselves. They'll blame the superintendent, the caddy. They'll blame somebody for messing up their game. And it's usually, they put a bad swing on it, So, but that's, I kind of got lost there in that conversation, but to get back to the superintendents, I think there's still, to really love this profession, you still got to work hard. I think a lot of guys are working pretty hard at it.
Well, Joe, thanks for joining us today.
Okay, thanks.